Hey everyone, this is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology, and today I am joined by my friend and colleague, Emma Frey, and we are going to continue our series on the Dharma of the Rising Signs by looking at some of the core mythology that is related with each of the 12 rising signs. And in particular, we're going to look at how that mythology of the rising signs actually plays out within the Hollywood stories portrayed by actors who have that rising sign. It's an interesting thing, but it's very common to see that a part of the way that the charts of artists will play out will be in and through the demonstrations of their artwork. That's whether it's music or painting or film, you will often see that major portions of an individual's birth chart will express themselves through the lens of their art. And you can do this across the board in so many different ways with astrology, but one of the most interesting ways, and this is the focus of this series, is to look at the rising signs of actors and actresses in Hollywood and some of the way in which the core mythology of the rising sign plays out in some of those prominent characters that these actors or actresses have played throughout their career. And if you want more on how this series works and the philosophical premise from the standpoint of ancient astrology, be sure to watch the first lecture where Emma and I take some time to break down the philosophical and archetypal background of this series and why we believe that it's actually something, it's a totally valid, and you can replicate this over and over and over again, looking at the charts of actors and actresses and seeing the archetypes in their charts reflected in some of the pivotal roles and stories that they play in film. Anyway, so more on that, visit the Aries episode, because part one, we kind of do a deeper philosophical dive to give you the background, a further context for the whole series, if you're curious about that. Today, we're going to be visiting the sign of Taurus. And so we will be looking at a variety of different core Taurian myths and how they have expressed themselves in the stories portrayed by actors and actresses with Taurus rising. Before we get into it, as always, don't forget to like and subscribe, share your comments and reflections. We'd love to hear from you. You can find a transcript of today's talk or any of our talks on the website, nightlightastrology.com. I also want to take you over there right now because I'm in the midst of promoting a new class that's coming up on February 15th. It's a single evening webinar, so not a huge commitment, just a single evening of talks. If you go to the website, you'll click on live events, or if you go to the events page, click on live events on the drop-down menu. Once you go there, you'll see that February 15th, I'm giving a talk called The Outer Planets and Our Relationships. I'll be doing three of these, one in February this month, next in March, and then in April. This is part one, where we're going to be looking at the role that Pluto plays in love and relationships, whether it is configured in some way to the topic through your natal chart, say an aspect of Venus or in the seventh house, or if by transit it is affecting something in your birth chart that has to do with the significations of love and relationships. The talk is dedicated to looking at the role that Pluto plays in love and relationships. So if you're interested in that, you can register on the website there under the live events tab. If you can't make it live, we send you a recording after you register to download, so you can be there live for the webinar and the Q&A that follows, or you can get the recording later. That's 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, February 15th. Registration is $20. Okay, well, on that note, I'm so happy to have my good friend Emma back on the show today. Hey, Emma.
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I'm really excited to continue this series. We got a ton of really great feedback the first time, and actually like a ton of questions that people were asking me, like, would there be other parts of celebrities? Well, not just celebrities, but in particular actors and actresses. Could we see other parts of their charts playing out in the films that they play? And although, Emma, your research has been mostly on rising signs, I think it's safe to say that if you did more, you could probably find more signatures in people's charts that reflect in big roles that they've played, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've started to look into it, but it gets overwhelming, I think, pretty quickly, just because I think that films can be pretty good mirrors for some reason, of real life when it comes to birth charts. And so my next project, if I ever were to want to dive deeper, I would probably want to look at the sun signs, because I think that's a fun place to go next with actors and how their stories show up and what characters they play, and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So it, I mean, you could get really deep with it if you wanted to take things like sun signs and the house that they're in. Like 12th house sun characters, I'm sure, abound or whatever.
Yeah.
There was, you know, there was another question that came in before we get into Taurus that I wanted to put past you and or run by you. Someone else said, aren't we mistaking the characters that people play for the person that they are by doing this? And my answer to that, and I'd like to hear yours too, but my answer was no, because the archetypes are multivalent. So when you have a, when you're looking at a rising sign, you're really talking about an entire mythology that will present through our character. And one of the things, one of the ways in which actors are experiencing the, their personal character in their life is through the roles that they play. And that has been historically documented by so many actors and actresses who have said that part of their own personal journey of self-exploration has been through the roles that they play. It's not to say that we're saying, oh, an actor is the same as the role that they play. What we're saying is that there's a mythological and archetypal correlation between the rising sign and some of the most significant roles that people play, and the way that as artists, and the way that that may actually play a fundamental role in their personal lifetime journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've grappled with this question too. I think what excites me is that as I'm doing this research, I'm a Virgo rising. And when I look at the Virgo rising stories, I can see how they play out in my life already so far. And I don't know. I'm way more interested and always have been in story than in looking at celebrities' personal lives. But the cursory research that I've done for looking at their personal lives is oftentimes similar to the arcs that they carry out in their films. It's subtler, and because real life is more mundane than the high stakes, high fantasy worlds of film. But I think that's what's so helpful about film, is that it kind of blows up these stories, these myths, into more easily recognizable formats. So that we can grab onto them and use them as we navigate our own more mundane lives, if right. That makes sense.
Yeah, to me, it wouldn't make any more, it'd make just as little sense to say that the art that someone makes has nothing to do with their chart as it would to say that a person is their art and nothing else, right? Like are extremes. I think this series lands somewhere in the middle and says, look, there's an interesting correlation between the charts of artists and the art that they portray or make. And so anyway, I thought that was a fun kind of a fun debate that was sparked in the comment section of the first video. And again, for people who are joining this, I recommend going back to the first video to also hear Emma break down some of the basic philosophy behind archetypal astrology and the history of archetypes in astrology, and how the ancient philosophy of astrology really supports the idea that a birth chart would show itself in many ways, including the ways in which artists portray themselves or different characters in movies. So anyway, go back to that one to see more.
And I will just say one more thing. I'm a Gemini sun, 10th houser. And so I actually, sometimes my brain hurts if I start trying to understand the why behind all of this. Mostly, like I do with my astrological physiognomy project, Patterns in the Stars, I just like to share data. I'm like, I'm seeing patterns across whatever, if it's photographs of celebrities, or in this case, character arcs in film. And those patterns are so strong and repeated that I think it's worth sharing. And so I would love to hear what people think is behind those patterns, but so much of my passion is just being like, hey, I found this pattern. What do you think? Isn't it cool?
Yeah. I love this. I love this series a lot too, because I think one of the things it does is it encourages us to see archetypes everywhere. So whatever you make of these connections is really up to you. we're just here presenting them and saying, as you said, like, look at how beautiful this correlation is. And it really is. There's so many interesting things. If you like Emma's work, I highly recommend after this today's video that you go check out Emma's Instagram, Patterns in the Stars, where you will see her making all sorts of fascinating patterns and associations between charts and sometimes the facial profiles or the look or appearance of various people who have similar placements in the chart. It's really, really fascinating work that she does. And you can also find more about Emma's work at her website, patternsinthestars.com. On that note, should we dive into Taurus?
Let's do it.
All right, let's go.
Okay, I'll share my screen.
Excuse me. Taurus is an interesting one because I feel like a lot of people might instantly have some images or ideas about Taurus, but I think people will be surprised by some of the really profound correlations that you made.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, when I first presented this entire project to you, this was one of the signs that I got excited about showing because I didn't expect to see the kinds of patterns that I did. It really was data first and then exploration second. And so you'll see that when I start diving into the films.
Awesome.
So Taurus, this is just a glyph. And then why don't we start, before we dive into the movies, with the core ancient Greek Taurus constellation myth, that of the divine bull. You may be probably most familiar with it if you are at all with the Minotaur portion of the myth and the labyrinth and Theseus. But starting from the beginning of the myth, there was this king, King Minos, and he was like, I want to sacrifice something really good to the gods. And so the gods were like, dope. Here's a divine bull. And Minos was so enamored of the bull that instead of sacrificing it like he had said that he would, he decided to keep it. And so to punish Minos, the gods cause his wife, the queen, to fall in love with the bull. And then she gives birth to a half-human, half-bull creature called the Minotaur, a very famous creature. The king was pretty ashamed of the Minotaur, one, because, you know, it was not his own, but also because it was kind of horrific, grotesque, very unnatural. And so because he was so ashamed, he had a labyrinth constructed to contain the Minotaur. And then eventually there was a hero that came in, Theseus, who volunteered to enter the labyrinth and slay the Minotaur, putting an end to the whole thing. And then with the help of the queen, of the king's daughter, Ariadne, who gave Theseus a ball of thread to navigate the maze, Theseus, the hero, successfully defeated the Minotaur, and again with the ball of thread, escaped the labyrinth. And so the whole thing was put to rest. And so there's a lot there. Obviously, you know, we know Taurus to be associated with the bull, so that connection makes a lot of sense. And from that, and based on the movies that and the patterns that I saw, kind of broke things out into three different themes that harken back to that myth. This one is definitely more complicated than Aries, but, you know, Aries is all about just breaking out of the darkness, and Taurus is about sustaining. So it's a little bit more, I think, not immediately apparent what's going on, but the themes are clearing of projections from oneself put upon someone by other people, or they could be false accusations. But on the other hand, before people start to get too comfortable in the victim position, there is a deliberate separation from a false or grandiose self, version of the self. And then there's finally like this return to Eden, a state of innocence, often represented by literal nature, the home. People often return home in Taurus rising stories, and a state of honesty, purity, all that Taurus stuff. So to help talk about this, illuminate a little bit further, with Taurus in terms of where it is in the year, we are not yet at the brightest point of the year that'll come at the end of Gemini season. But at Taurus, we see the sustaining of the rising of the dominance of the light. That's the best way of describing what is happening. The sun at this point is working to arrive at its peak point, but it's not there yet. If you're looking at it from like a microcosmic, just like day view, I think of it as like mid-morning. It's not quite at high noon yet, but it's making its way there. And so literally what we have is, not literally, but like from our vantage point, the sun is fully separate from the ground. It's fully separate from the earth. It's released itself from the confines of the earth. It's free and light. Astrologically, esoterically, is often correlated with consciousness, life, clarity, control, you know, apart from the surrender associated with death. It is a triumph of light, consciousness, and clarity. And so we're bringing that consciousness higher, and it becomes more dominant with Taurus. So digging into the first theme that we see is the clearing of projections or false accusations. And I'm going to start with Linda Blair, who plays Regan McNeil in The Exorcist, 1973. I don't think that many Taurus risings will go through literal exorcisms in their lifetime, but I think it's a really good metaphorical visual of what can happen, which is that something comes into, we see this person is infected with a demon. And over the course of the film, you could say that Theseus comes in to slay the Minotaur, or the Hierophant, the shaman, the priest, Father Karras, if you're familiar with the film. I'm going to be spoiling all these, I think, so that's just a warning right now. And so it's simple. It is The Exorcist is what it is. It's an exorcism, and the Hierophant is the exorcist in many ways. The Hierophant is Taurus's card, by the way. Yeah, there's this thing, this external thing, the demon Paimon, that comes in and then is expelled. And I think that that's similar in many ways to like this clearing of the Minotaur. It's getting rid of this unnatural thing, and bringing Regan back to a state of rightful child innocence.
There's a kind of the word possession, you know, that's such a Taurus word.
Yeah.
That we end up talking about in terms of material things, but it's Minos who becomes possessed in a way and possessive of the bull. Mm-hmm. And then he has to become dispossessed, and the exorcism is in the removal of the Minotaur, which is in a way his own shadow. I'm not suggesting that that's exactly what's going on in The Exorcist, but the idea of possession and exorcising something that possesses is so closely connected to Minos.
Yeah. And I think we'll see a lot of this is that a lot of Taurus risings go on types of journeys to expel their demons. And Adam, I know that you went through some ayahuasca journeys, and that process can be, not to be vulgar, but a lot of Taurus risings I've noted literally get sick in their films. And there is like this visual representation of like the expulsion of like
vomiting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, that does happen. That did happen as a Taurus rising, I can attest.
Yeah. So glad we started with that one.
I know, right?
But the next one is actually really pretty similar. It's another horror. So sorry if anyone here doesn't like horror, trying to keep this pretty heart-centered. But this is Mia Farrow, who plays Rosemary Woodhouse in Rosemary's Baby from 1968. And this is so literal, I think, to the myth. It's kind of funny. If you haven't seen the movie, poor Rosemary is, she's taken by Satan in the form of like a bull, and is forced to carry his child. It's very awful, but it's a great movie. And then eventually she gives birth to the child, like kind of separating herself from it. And while she's pregnant, it is like sucking the life out of her. And she looks almost as bad as Reagan does in The Exorcist. There's like this, like, you know, this thing is leeching off of you and sucking the life out of you. And you won't feel better until it's like out of you. Kind of like when you're sick and you feel just awful and you like you don't want to vomit, but when you do vomit, you feel better like instantly.
Yep.
So
that's that couldn't be more literal in terms of the actual the imagery of the bull as well.
It's wild. It's pretty good. If you are interested, if you haven't seen it, for anyone, I highly recommend that movie. Okay, so we're going to move on from horror and revisit some older black and white movies, that both of which I really like. This one is called Gilda from 1946, and it stars Rita Hayworth as the titular character, Gilda. In this movie, Gilda is seen as kind of like a kind of a harlot, kind of someone who is she's accused of not being faithful to her husband, and she has a really famous song called Put the Blame on Mame, and she kind of does a song and dance number, and she's like, she's taking all this blame. This is where I kind of have the false accusations, like this stuff that gets infected put onto her, and over the course of the film she's like exonerated, and someone actually sees her for who she actually is, and the lies about her betrayal and cheating scandals are put to rest. So that's Gilda. And then Mr. Gary Cooper as Longfellow Deeds in Mr. Deeds Goes to Town from 1936. I think this is the oldest film I have. This is also very similar to The Myth in the fact that it's textbook, rags to riches. So King Minos is given this divine bull, which could also be looked at as like a lot of money or a lot of whatever is valuable, something valuable, large sum of something. Deeds starts off the movie as very like middle class, like well-to-do, but nothing to write home about. But then he gets this giant sum of inheritance money, giant for the time. And, you know, people try to tell him who he is after that point, and they sometimes make fun of him because of his background and his like simple way of thinking. And eventually they even call into question his sanity, and he's put on trial for to see if he's sane. And he won't speak. He's so fed up with other people trying to control him, telling him who he is, and you know, the whole entire ordeal of what he's gone through. And then one person finally speaks up for him and sees him for who he actually is underneath all the craziness, and that's when he finds his voice and is able to kind of speak for himself and come back to who he really is.
I like that one. I haven't seen that one before.
And then, well, I do recommend it. It's old, but it's like super charming, and Gary Cooper is just a doll, and it's good. And we'll see the rags to riches theme, I forgot to say, like across a lot of these and in different ways. Like it's not necessarily just money, but it is like status and stuff like that.
Yep.
Okay. And then my last actor for this theme is Halle Berry, who plays Janie in Their Eyes Were Watching God from 2005. And Janie goes through a few different marriages, relationships, and they all kind of want different things from her, just like with Mr. Deeds. And then Gilda's, all of these characters, for some reason, people want something from them, and they want them to be something. And they have something of value. And so there's like this clawing at them to have them be something for them. And she goes through a number of different relationships like that until she meets Tea Cake. And he sees her for who she actually is, and not just the duties of a wife and what, you know, these projected expectations are for wifely duties or whatever. And there's a really beautiful scene at the very end of the movie where she like is just bathing in a pond, and it's like she's kind of really found her soul and who she is right. Underneath all of other people's expectations.
I'll never forget, I had a reading from Stephen Forrest years ago where he was, you know, talking about the different facets of my birth chart. And when he got to Taurus rising, he said a lot of different things, but one of the things he said was to be careful, because Taurus risings make people feel at ease. They're naturally like, you know, you be in a room with a Taurus rising, you often just feel like there's a comfort and an ease that you feel like you can just sink into yourself when you're with Taurus. Mm-hmm. But being sort of amicable and easygoing, people will try to take things from you. People will try to, there'll also be a lot of projections that people put on you because you're easy. There's like an openness and an easiness that is an unfortunately good spot for projections. And I think we're basically identifying in all of these Taurus rising actors, they've played roles that have had elements of this mythology that have gone along with them. Like whether you think of it as, you know, the characters in the horror films, even that they somehow make targets for these projections. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. And those projections can come in film in the form of like a demon or something that comes inside, because you can internalize projections, and that's when it gets really gnarly, because you start to identify with them. Like Minos kept keeping the bull, and you can't like identify, you have to clear it and return back to yourself. And so the last one I will hand over to you. Here we go.
Yeah. So this is Brendan Fraser in a great movie. It came out, I want to say it was 1992. Yep. It's called School Ties. Mm-hmm. And he plays a 17-year-old working class Jewish boy from a Jewish family at a prep school. That's what I'm trying to say. And so he is, throughout the film, basically he receives the prejudice of like his classmates, you know, people putting all sorts of different things, projecting all sorts of different things onto him that are false. And it's obviously like in so many ways, it's a film about prejudice, but the story also involves a cheating scandal at the school, which he gets falsely accused for. And a lot of the story is about the clearing of the projections from anti-Semitism, and the clearing of a major specific accusation of being a cheater, when he was innocent. And so, you know, and he obviously is a Taurus rising. He appears in another one of our lists later, but a film that's really all about exercising the demon of a major false accusation. You know, you could put it that way.
Yeah. That's so hard to handle, especially if no one's there to kind of speak up for you. It's a really difficult thing to deal with. It's crazy because the character right above him also dealt with like a cheating scandal.
A great movie, still holds up. I watched it a couple years ago now again, and it has like a little bit of the 90s like Dead Poets Society prep school vibe. But obviously, you're instead of like a bunch of romantics, you're dealing with a bunch of jerks, and you know, so it's like a very different environment. But it has that kind of 90s prep school Dead Poet Society vibe a little bit. So it's a good movie to watch.
Nice. All right. So then that wraps up the first category. And the second is kind of the same, but it's more like a self-imposed projection. So this is separation from a false grandiose self. And so the first one that I, the first example I have is Kate Blanchett playing Lydia Tarr in 2022's Tarr. She plays a very famous, very accomplished conductor who goes by the name of Lydia Tarr, and she speaks very well. And the first time we see her in the movie, she's giving like this public interview, and it's, you know, she's like made it. But over the course of the movie, we learn that she has been using her power for bad. She has been coercing the younger members of her orchestra into relationships with her, and really not using her power well at all. And because more eyes are coming onto her, more consciousness from the outside, you know, as she gains this fame, she gets canceled, to coin a current word. And then she ends up going back home, back to her childhood home, where we learn that her actual name is Linda Tarr. And it's spelled, the last name is spelled differently. It's just spelled more, you know, colloquially. And she finally also sees like the impact of what she's done, the negative impact. There's this really good scene where she recognizes what she's done and how bad it is. And she gets sick, she vomits. And that's like toward the very end. And so it's all, I think this one's also very textbook. It's, you know, if we think that the first category, I think a lot of people would be like, yes. But I think, you know, sometimes there are things that we do ourselves, and when we bring consciousness to ourselves, not just from the outside, but when we can cancel ourselves and see like the harm that we've done, and it makes us sick, and then we can get it out, we can express it, and then we come back to like who we really are underneath all of the grandiosity.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I had to include a movie from my childhood. This is the Hannah Montana movie starring Miley Cyrus, Taurus Rising. And this is pretty like self-explanatory. The movie starts off with Miley Stewart, who has like her alter ego, Hannah Montana. I think everyone knows. She's a very, very famous, well-loved pop star. Miley wears this blonde wig, and at the start of the movie, she is fighting with Tyra Banks in like a Louboutin store, and then the paparazzi find her, and it's this whole thing, and she just feels really entitled to this life, to the material goods that come with fame and all of that. And then her dad is like, I'm sending you back to the family farm, and that's where the bulk of the movie takes place, is like she's taking the wig off, and she is remembering her real name. She hangs out with her grandma, and she kind of allows herself to not become as identified with the Hannah Montana character that got so famous.
I haven't seen that one, but I'll have to take your word for it.
Next movie night, you know?
Yep. My girls might like that.
They probably would. My friends and I went to the movies when it came out, and there was no one else in the theater, and we all like danced. We did the hoedown throwdown for anyone that knows what that is. it was so much fun. Okay, next one is Liza Minnelli from 1972's Cabaret. She plays Sally Bowles, and Sally starts off the movie with this very larger than life personality and self-conception. She thinks she's just the greatest. She kind of talks, she puts on airs, and she kind of, you know, the way that she just holds herself is, it's just like a caricature of a celebrity. And she has this clear image in her mind of like how great she is. But she's very poor at the start of the movie. And then this guy comes in who just has a ton of money, and he like kind of parades her around town, and he gives her caviar whenever she asks for it and fine clothes. And she just starts to think like, oh, is he gonna like propose to me? And then of course not, he leaves and she's left with nothing. I think he like gives her $100 or something. And yeah, there's just, by the end of the movie, she's had a very clear sort of like humbling and has returned to just a more honest state.
Yeah.
Then I think this is my last one potentially for this category. Vivien Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. Very famous. You probably know the character pretty well. Again, larger than life, thinks very highly of herself and identifies with her wealth, and then goes through a very, very, very famous humbling at the end when it comes to the man that she, you know, had been telling her he loved her, and she rebukes him and then he leaves her. And there's a similar sort of humbling that happens in A Streetcar Named Desire, where she plays Blanche. It's just starting off with this entitled perspective of everything that you think you deserve. And then it just, you know, you go through this kind of humbling over the course of the movie that if you don't invite it in, it will probably happen to you externally.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then we have another Cate Blanchett.
Yeah, so this one is Blue Jasmine, which came out in 2013. Went and saw this one at the movie theater with Ashley. It's a Woody Allen movie, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she plays a woman, a super entitled, sort of snobby woman who loses all of her money and has to go back to her sister's place. And the film is basically one humbling moment after another, where she's basically got to come to terms with the fact that this constructed self that she's built on wealth and privilege has completely fallen apart. And I think it was her husband ended up being convicted of fraud and they lost all their money. And then living with her sister, who she sees as like beneath her. But it turns out there's a lot of heart and soul that come from her roots that she's separated from through delusion and that she is trying to sort of get back to. But I don't know, it's a little tragic because it's sort of like she's an example of someone who kind of can't let go and is sort of spiraling in a nervous breakdown from the shattered image of herself and the loss of wealth and prestige and everything. It's kind of a dark comedy. Like, I think people would find it to be like kind of, it's a fun movie, even though it sounds a little bleak. But yeah, she's coming undone one step at a time. And it all comes from a completely delusional sense of self that came about through a temporary rise in wealth.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of that rags to riches theme where it can go from rags to riches or riches to rags. But the question is always at the core, like, is there a real self in here, or are we getting possessed by some false image or something like that?
Yeah. Are we getting identified with like these goods that have come our way and the status? And yeah, I got to rewatch that one. I remember really liking the script.
Yeah. Well, here we have Taylor Lautner and Robert Pattinson. Am I getting their names right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I noticed this when we were looking through, and Emma had most of the notes and I was just kind of perusing. And I was like, you know, what's interesting is that they both play characters in the Twilight series who, well, first they deal with a lot of projections that people put on them. Are they monsters or are they not? Like, that's a they transform from human to vampire and are contending with, you know, I'm not like Robert Pattinson's character, was it Edward? Is that his name in the series? Mm-hmm. I think it is. He's basically contending with whether or not he loves this, you know, girl in, what's her name? I forget the actress's name.
Kristen Stewart.
Or does he want to like drink her blood, you know? And he has to control the bloodthirst and stay in touch with the real self that loves her. But also he's working to sort of embrace and be okay with the fact that like he's also a vampire. And the same thing for Taylor Lautner in the series. There's a lot of dealing with these dual images of themselves as Minotaur, or, you know, like the bull versus the Minotaur. Yeah. And so I just think that they both deal with at times like grandiose ideas about who they are. And they both are trying to constantly stay in touch with some essence of who they are, despite their shape-shifting nature.
Yeah. Yeah. And like those powers, the werewolf and vampire, that brings them both like a lot of power and, mm-hmm. You know, it can take over someone when they overly identify. And like, they're both like kind of trying to keep their humanity alive underneath like the beast, the vampire or the werewolf. There's like there's a huge Twilight fan growing up, so I can give all the details. There's like a famous scene at the end of the first movie where Edward has to save Bella and he has to like drink her blood. And he like almost kills her because he can't control himself.
That's right.
Yeah. So has to like remember the human underneath.
Oh yeah.
Good stuff. We'll do Kristen Stewart next in Gemini Rising. So sweet.
Good.
And then last category is a very expected one, maybe for Taurus, which is a return to Eden, which can also be seen as nature, literally in film, but more figuratively, a state of innocence, childlike innocence, purity, honesty, and then often literally home. We've already seen it in the other two categories. These characters will often return home in some way, whether it's the place that they grew up or their grandmother's farm, like in Hannah Montana. There's this pull back to wherever they hailed.
Right.
And so first off, we have, again, Robert Pattinson in David Eggers' The Lighthouse, which is
such a dark movie.
It's so good. It's a movie about these two men, Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, are like these lighthouse stewards. I don't remember what the actual word is, but they're
keeper,
like...
I think. Lighthouse keeper.
Oh yeah, I think yeah, that's it. They're just like going insane because there's nothing around them. They're just in this lighthouse, and like I don't really know. I can't really tell you exactly what happens, but I do know that the character at the end of the movie is like he has become sort of a part of nature and like devolved like over the course of the movie, like he is sort of losing his mind and sort of like losing like his conception of himself as like this put together person, and eventually like succumbs to like this like nature beast thing. I don't know. This is one I can't really talk about super coherently, but the end image I think is indicative of just like going back to nature and being a part of it. So
yeah, there's definitely like, this was something I wrote at and did several podcasts on this movie when it first came out.
Really?
Because yeah, this was some years ago. It came out right around Halloween and I went and saw it like three times in the theater, and then I did a couple of podcasts on it. They were I was on YouTube at that point. So but one of the things that I would say about this movie is that you have, there's a whole bunch of different, I feel like there's three or four different mythic strands in this film that you could go on for, you know, different, probably different, that follow different tracks than just the Taurus Rising. But the one thing that I'll say about this is that there's a there are troubled backgrounds for there's troubled backgrounds for both of the characters in the lighthouse, the two keepers. And there's a coming to terms with something in them that is, I would almost call it amoral. It's just sort of bestial, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. And they have to kind of come to terms with it. But as they do, it's threatening to shatter the light, which would be like sanity, right? So you have mm-hmm. that theme of like returning to nature, but also that really razor thin line between letting nature completely possess and consume to the point where you lose the light. Mm-hmm. And also not being so controlled that you're like a fugitive from your own nature. You're on the run mm-hmm. or you're trying to escape from it somehow. So the yeah. movie is really about them walking that fine line between the two things.
Mm. Are those still around, like those podcasts?
Yeah. They're somewhere backlogged in my YouTube. And I don't remember if I, in the title, I don't remember if I said something about the lighthouse in the title, but it was during, I'm pretty sure it would have been around Scorpio season. So if I could, I'll look back and see if I can find it. Cause I talked also yeah. about Prometheus and, because there's this whole thing with them yeah. getting obsessed with the light too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, anyway, it's that movie was like, to me, that was like a psychedelic mandala of mythology. There was so much in that film.
Yeah. The director is coming out with a Nosferatu movie this year. Oh, so God. I'm so excited.
Oh, that sounds great. I think he did The Witch too. Did you see that?
Yes. Yeah. That was also similar.
Disturbing. Yeah.
Yeah. Psychedelic.
There's a huge thing there though about nature and paganism yeah. and yeah,
return.
It's fascinating.
Ugh. Good stuff. Okay. I'm going to group the next two together because they're very, very similar. Again, we have Brendan Fraser for the second time as George in George of the Jungle. And then I have Daryl Hannah as Madison in Splash from the 80s. And they're both like nature creatures. My dog is being interesting. They're nature creatures who end up going to the big city and like grappling with like fashion, and they're given money and like kind of almost tested in a way. And people want different things from them. But they eventually, they find one person who sees them for like who they actually are underneath like this beast, quote unquote. And then they can kind of like return back to this like state of like he goes back to the jungle with Ursula and she goes back underwater with Tom Hanks' character in Splash. They're just like very similar. And I think that, yeah, like grappling with like the noise and the craziness of like the big city is kind of like a theme of being introduced to like all these riches. Like Minos.
It's funny that mermaids play an interesting role in the lighthouse as well. We'll just leave it like that.
Oh, they do. A very interesting role.
I know.
Which is interesting because it's like the hybridization of like the yeah. the person. It's like the literalizing that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then we have Sigourney Weaver, who plays Dr. Grace in James Cameron's Avatar, which I saw in the movie theater like four times when it came out. Like, I loved yeah, that movie. That oh amazing. My God. So good. And she is like the nature mama of the group. She actually cares about the Na'vi, blue cat people. And eventually she does die, but she is welcomed into the arms of Awa, the giant tree spirit that is like the mother source for the tribe. Yeah, there's that. Yeah,
That's a great example of the archetype.
Yeah. And then my last one is, I had to include it. I really like this movie. It's a French New Wave film called Jouer les Gym. And it stars Taurus rising Jean Moreau. Very similar to Cabaret, which I included in the last category with Liza Minnelli. Excuse me. Jean Moreau is like this larger than life character who is like the doppelganger of a statue in the movie. And two men are just taken by her immediately. And the three of them kind of like are just frolicking around. There's like kind of the same thing is happening in Cabaret, but eventually she and her partner return to Paris. Like originally they were in Austria. It's hard to explain. It's kind of complicated-ish, but there is the theme of like just like having to go back to where you come from and you can't like escape for very long. Eventually you'll be brought back. All right, and then the last one, again, we have Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, so this one is The Whale, which came out, I want to say, last year?
Yeah, maybe it was last year.
I think it was last year. So in this movie, Brendan Fraser plays a man who's morbidly obese and struggling with basically trying to restore a relationship with his daughter. And obviously, a lot of the film revolves around his struggles with food and with his health. And there's like, to me, you could put this film and his character in several different categories, where the struggle of being possessed with something and trying to exercise himself of something, the possession quality is, I think, really strong in this movie. So like you could almost put it there. But there's also something about this where, like, for example, he's obsessed with an essay that his daughter wrote it was on Moby Dick. And obviously the story of Moby Dick, which the title of the film comes from, that's a big piece of why they call it The Whale, has to do with the Titanic forces of nature that we can't harness or control. And of course, Ahab in the book represents someone who's trying to dominate nature and trying to control and kill and take and sort of objectify the whale. And so it's a deep movie. It had some mixed reception too. Like there were some people who were very critical of it and so on, for the portrayal of morbid obesity and whether it was like considered to be really accurate or not and so forth. But I think just archetypally, the struggle between the possessive false sort of nature is that's what his character is struggling with throughout the entire film. And in this kind of sense of trying to get back to something innocent and pure that he feels like he's lost, which is sort of symbolized by the relationship with his daughter and this essay that she wrote also about the forces of nature, which can't really be harnessed. And that's sort of the sort of tragic piece of the movie as well. So it's a really complicated film. I really liked it. I don't know if I could ever watch it again. It was hard to watch. It was a movie that was very hard to watch, but I felt like a lot of the Taurian themes were streaming through it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was, I feel the same way. I'm like, I enjoyed it and I got a lot out of it, but it was a hard watch.
Yeah. There is I won't give it away, but at the end, there's almost like a similar, not identical, but a similar kind of like leaving off point that the lighthouse has, where there's just this kind of like this image at the end that points toward trying to get back to something or transforming into something, and reaching some state of innocence or purity, that's complex.
Yeah. Getting to some higher place of consciousness.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. These were good. Nice. All of these categories were so good. Yeah, tell people, how can they get a hold of you? I'm going to put some of this up on the screen again, because your work is so fantastic. I love this. This has stimulated my imagination so much to look at the connection between the rising signs of actors and actresses and the roles they've played. And to also use this as a fun way to just describe and deepen our understanding of the rising signs, or the signs in general and their mythology. You can find Emma on Instagram at Patterns in the Stars, at patternsinthestars.com. And your email address, I guess, is right there too.
Yeah, it's just all the things, Patterns in the Stars. I really started off just at all those locations. You're mostly going to find my work with astrological physiognomy, seeing visual patterns in the stars. But this work that I'm doing right now with the rising signs is really my passion point, is seeing these other patterns in the stars, the movie stars. And it's just fun to like find new data to explore that the internet can afford to us. And it's just really fun. And I love being able to do it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate having you here on the program again, on the podcast. And we will be doing it again. And next on our list is going to be Gemini.
Yes, I'm so excited. I have a lot of Gemini rising friends. I'm a Gemini sun. So they've all been anxiously waiting this one. So
yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be fun to work through these. And as we go deep in the conversation around the topic too. So we appreciate all of you guys who have made some fun conversation around these videos in the chat box and shared your own observations between archetypes and films and TV and other things. One of the best ways to learn and grow as an astrologer is to just be in the habit of noticing mythology and mythological patterns in the entertainment that you take in. This is art. This is the way that art has been conveyed through archetypes for thousands of years in theater, and now on the film and Netflix and everywhere else. And if we can keep our relationship with this viewing archetypal, then I think that art can still be medicine, just like music was medicine long ago. And so hopefully this series, you know, also contributes to that consciousness of staying in touch with archetypes on the day-to-day. And for that, we have Emma to thank for all of your really wonderful research. So thanks again for being here. Thank you everybody for listening, and we will see you guys again next time. Take it easy, everyone. Mm-hmm.